This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moskowain. We're in the middle of the first open enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act. The deadline to sign up is March 31st, in case you don't already know. And we have two guests in the studio to help sort out some of the confusion surrounding Obamacare. Rob Field is a professor of law and health policy at Drexel University. He's the author of the recently released book, Mother of Invention, How the Government Created Free Market Healthcare. And also in the studio is David Grandy. He's an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, where he specializes in health policy, and he's a senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics. Welcome both of you to Radio Times.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Good morning.
I want to start with a couple of items that have been in the news recently. Rob Field, let's talk first about the employer mandate. Earlier this month, the administration delayed the requirement for employers to provide health insurance, and this was just for medium-sized firms between 50 and 99 workers, as I understand it. The requirement kicks in 2 years later now, 2016. What's happening here?
Right. So this is the second delay. The first one is they delayed the whole mandate for 1 year until 2015, and then they delayed it for medium-sized firms, as you said, 50 to 100 employees, until 2016. And for larger firms over than 100, they modified it. So you only have to show that you've provided insurance to 70% of your employees rather than 95%, which the law had required. The employer mandate is a sort of odd add-on to this. The main purpose of the law is to insure the people who don't have access to employer-based coverage, and now they can go into an exchange regardless of health status. But the fear was that employers would then start dropping coverage and say, now that my workers can get it elsewhere, why bother? So this is a way to maintain employer-based coverage. So it's not essential to the functioning of the law, but it's important to the overall mechanism of gears that sort of make it operate.
So how would this convince employers not to change work hours or something like that to sort of get around the requirements?
So the work hours is another issue, and that remains in place. The law has this cliff at 50 employees. If you have 50 or more, you're subject to the mandate and you have to provide it. Whether it's next year or 2016, that will catch up with you eventually. If you have fewer than 50, you don't have to provide it. And if you have much less than that, you might even get a subsidy for providing the coverage. So if you can keep the number of full-time workers, those working 30 hours or less, below the 50, you're home free.
Okay. And so the delay then is just to give those employers a little more time to kind of incorporate this into their plans?
Right. Because it could be disruptive for some of them. The larger companies all are providing the insurance. This isn't going to change a whole lot for them. But particularly the medium-sized companies, it might involve some retooling.
Okay. And we got a little bit into the hours. So this is for employers or employees who are full-time. I mean, if I own a business, why not just cut everyone down to part-time?
That is perhaps the most vulnerable point, the Achilles heel of the whole law, is that we're already seeing some employers deciding to push people down to 29 hours or less. In fact, there's a report today that a lot of public agencies, police departments, sanitation departments, schools, are putting people on part-time status to get around the mandate. The opponents of the law say this is the job killer provision. The supporters of the law say it's happening, but it's not an epidemic and it's in control.
It's going to be interesting to see how that one works out.
Yes.
I want to switch to something else that's been in the news recently and specific to Pennsylvania. David Grandy, just this week, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett's administration submitted a formal waiver for expanding the state's Medicaid program, although I don't think he likes to consider it an expansion of the state's Medicaid program under the Affordable Care Act. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, so as background, I think it's important to know that the way the Affordable Care Act intended to expand coverage was a combination of giving people financial help to purchase private health insurance on their own, and that's these new healthcare exchanges, healthcare marketplaces, that's healthcare.gov. The other main way that coverage was intended to be expanded was through an expansion of the Medicaid program and an increase in the income eligibility for that program. And the way the law was designed was there was anticipated about half of the newly covered people would be through Medicaid and about half of the newly covered people would be through expanded private insurance, subsidized private insurance. So Pennsylvania has lagged behind in terms of expanding its own Medicaid program. So right now, as of, you know, February 2014, our state, if you live below 133% of the federal poverty level and you don't have insurance, there's no option for you if you're not eligible for the old Medicaid program right now. So we are about a year behind schedule in terms of getting our program expanded, and the governor came kind of late to the table in terms of a proposal. So then the question is, what is he proposing, and why is that controversial? Well, some states have tried to push the federal government in terms of negotiating for things that it wants, in terms of its agreement to go along with the expansion. And a few things that the governor has asked for that are very controversial. One is he wants to start charging premiums in the Medicaid program for people who are pretty low income. And second is he wants to require people who work less than 20 hours a week to start proving that they're looking for a job. And there's really no precedent in the Medicaid program for this. So this is likely to be a key point of conflict between the federal government and the state of Pennsylvania and whether or not the federal government will go along with this. There are other controversial provisions as well, but that probably is one of the biggest ones right now.
Now, some other states have gone to the federal government and say, okay, we see how you want to do it. We want to do it a little bit differently. Can you give us a waiver so that we can do it our way? Has any other state tried to do what Governor Corbett is talking about here?
Well, there's the part of the Pennsylvania proposal that's been done by a few other states is to try to send people over to the private insurance marketplaces to get their coverage instead of putting them in the traditional Medicaid program. But some of these other things, like job search requirements, have never been approved in another state. And even states who have tried to charge premiums, the federal government has pushed back on how big those premiums can be. So this definitely goes further than any other state. Arkansas is always the state that people point to as the first one to come forward with this quote-unquote private option within their Medicaid program. But even in Arkansas, that's continued to be controversial and potentially unraveling.
So is it fair for us then to see what Governor Corbett's administration is proposing here as sort of like a bargaining point?
It could be, or you could be cynical and say he's putting a poison pill in it, knowing that the feds are not going to approve the work requirement. And then he could say that he tried to expand Medicaid and the Obama administration wouldn't let him. But he's certainly, at the very least, pushing the limits here, and there will be intense bargaining over it.
And, pardon me, David Grandy, this proposal then, is it designed to save money? You've written about this, right?
Well, so you mean the governor's proposal on the Medicaid
Corbett's
program?
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I've never seen a compelling case that any of these approaches relying on private insurance are going to save any money. In fact, the states are supposed to prove that they're not going to spend more money or that they may, in fact, save money. It turns out private insurers pay doctors and hospitals much higher prices than what state Medicaid programs do. And so somehow, you know, they have to make up that difference. So how they're not going to spend more money by shunting people into private insurance is not clear to me, and no one's ever made a convincing case to me of how that can be true. In the state of Arkansas, they had about a 23% difference in price in how much doctors and hospitals were being paid between their Medicaid program and the private insurance. And what the state of Arkansas argued is over time, their state Medicaid program would have to increase what they pay doctors and hospitals. There's no precedent in history to suggest that Medicaid payments are ever going to get close to what private insurers pay providers. So I don't know. I think that, you know, it's a hard thing to believe that this could save money.
So if it's likely not going to save money, then is the purpose for asking for the waiver more of an ideological thing?
I think it very much is. It makes it more palatable to conservatives. They can say, we're not expanding a government program. We're just facilitating the private market. Certainly in Arkansas, which is now a red state, that would have gone over much better. Although right now, the Republicans in the legislature are pushing back, and it seems like even that won't survive. But it's very much an ideological battle between wanting to take the money but not wanting to expand the government's direct involvement.
We have two experts on the Affordable Care Act in the studio here, David Grandy of Penn. You've heard just from Rob Field from Drexel there. They're ready to answer your questions, too. Give us a call, 1-888 877-9499. You can email us, radiotimes@why.org, and on Twitter, we are at WHYY Radio Times. You know, I think my first impression is that implementing this law has not gone smoothly at all. But then I sit back and I think it's a really complicated law, and they've taken on a huge task here of reforming our entire healthcare system. So when you consider that, maybe the implementation hasn't been that much of a rocky road. What do you both think of that? Let's first talk with you, Rob Ford.
Sure. So in my new book, Mother of Invention, I look at the way government programs really created the system we have today. We call it a private sector system, but actually the government is behind every major sector of healthcare. And we've seen this going back 50 years before Medicare, although that was the big event that transformed hospitals and the medical profession and even the insurance profession. Medicare itself was a very rocky rollout. It took a year for the government to send people out to rural areas to tell them there was this new program. They got doors shut in their faces. The AMA threatened to boycott it. A lot of people thought this would never get off the ground. And then we have the Medicare Part D program, which started in 2006 to add prescription drug benefits under Medicare. That was very similar, actually, to Obamacare, getting people to get on a website and buy coverage from private plans. That had a very rocky rollout, computer crashes, people not understanding what the website was telling them. It took a couple of years. It's now running smoothly. It's a very popular program. So there very much is precedent for exactly what's happening today.
And David Grandy, is this is it fair to see this as a rocky rollout considering the enormity of the task?
Well, it's clearly an enormous task, but also at the same time, clearly there was huge mistakes made with the first couple months in terms of having the website ready to go. It obviously didn't work. Much of those initial, what were more IT as opposed to policy glitches, seem to have been ironed out. Healthcare.gov seems to be working well now in terms of people getting signed up, people getting enrolled, people being able to shop for coverage. But I think the bottom line is health insurance is complicated. It's not like, you know, going out and buying a television or a radio. And it's always going to be hard. It's hard if people are going through their employer. It's hard if people are going through healthcare.gov.
Yeah. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act here on Radio Times. My guests are David Grandy, who you just heard from there. He's an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Rob Field is here as well. He's a law and health policy professor at Drexel University. Have you signed up yet during the open enrollment period that's underway right now? What was that experience like? We'd like to hear from you. Give us a call. The phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Also, you can send an email to radiotimes@why.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be back after a break.
Support for WHYY comes from Delaware Valley College. Delaware Valley College offers a Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology that prepares culturally competent practitioners to work in the mental health field. Students can choose from social justice community counseling or child and adolescent counseling. More information about a Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology from Delaware Valley College is available online at delval.edu/grad.
Starting in the 1950s, African Americans on the radio began changing the country.
We were the little engine that could, and we were going to fight the big guys.
They had a sound you couldn't hear anywhere else.
Ooh, tiddly off, let's make way for the jock. Look, pull all through, later, Gator. Gotta cut. Hello there, Douglas.
I'm Kenny Gamble. Tune in for Going Black, the legacy of Philly Soul Radio.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, schools around the U.S. have had to cancel classes a lot this winter, and some are now requiring kids to attend remotely.
School is canceled for all Governor Wentworth schools. However, today we are holding a blizzard bag day.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
You're listening to Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, and for Marty Moskowain, we're talking about Obamacare with Rob Field of Drexel University and David Grandy of Penn. And a lot of people have questions. We're going to go directly to the telephones here to answer some of those questions. First, we have Linda from Downington, PA. And Linda, you have a question for our guests.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have a quick question. I'm on a limited benefit plan that has been extended through halfway through 2014 till the end of June. It's after the March 31st enrollment period, but before, from what I understand, the fall enrollment period. So what? Why would a company pick halfway through the year to drop you? And then what do we do to get coverage since we're in between enrollment periods?
Okay, thank you for your question. Let's define limited benefit. This is one of the requirements of the law that you have to have a certain level of benefits offered, right?
Right. So the law says it has to have certain what they call essential benefits, services that it has to cover, preventive services, hospitalization, and so forth. And it also says there has to be a limit on the amount that you're responsible for, your total out-of-pocket cost of no more than about $6,200, and it has to have no limit on the amount you run up each year or on in your lifetime. So a lot of the limited benefit policies lack one or more of those features. The insurance company is, in fact, leaving you in a pretty awkward situation because open enrollment closes March 31st. You cannot go onto an exchange until next, I think it's November 1st. So my advice would be to go on March 31st, get a policy to begin May 1st, you can have it be a month lapse, and then you would only have an extra month on your limited benefit policy.
And David Grandy, this kind of situation, it seems like there are so many different kinds of problems that kind of emerge here, and we're just hearing one from Linda there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a lot of people out there who are on these very limited benefit plans currently. And I think that the big problem with them is even though the price of them tends to be low, I think if people get into any kind of health difficulties, they find out that their coverage, in fact, doesn't protect them very well and can be a huge economic hit to a family if they experience an illness. So, you know, I think to the extent that people get into these new coverage options, they're going to be much more financially protected if they experience an illness in their family.
Yeah, hard to think about that, though, when you're looking at a higher premium in the meantime.
Sure.
Let's go back to the telephone, and we have Ian from Bristol, PA. Ian, you have a question for our guests.
Yes, I do. I was just wondering why it costs so much to get a knee replacement in one state when it's so cheap to do it in another. I believe I saw a video online, and I know you can't believe everything you believe online, but I saw a video where you can literally go fly to Spain, live there for 2 years, get your knee replaced, learn Spanish, and then come back. And it's cheaper to get your knee replaced there than it is here. I find it absolutely ridiculous that some hospitals can charge $80,000 to get your knee replaced when, in all honesty, it probably costs $10,000.
Thank you for that question. Controlling the cost of healthcare, that's part of this, right, David Grandy?
Yeah, and the caller is pointing to a problem that we see in healthcare where there's huge variation in pricing, both within the United States from hospital to hospital, city to city. But then people also are very disgruntled when they find out what the caller identified, that prices in our country are so much higher than they are in other countries. And honestly, the main reason for that is, the country the caller identified, as well as many other countries that have those lower prices, have much more regulated systems than what we have. So they have regulated pricing in their healthcare industry. Our prices are determined through private negotiations between insurance companies and providers. There's some regulation because Medicare ultimately is setting prices within that program. Collectively, there's a lot of private negotiation that goes on in our healthcare industry, and that's where prices come from in the United States.
And is there any part of this law that's aimed at controlling some of those prices?
Not directly. It tries to empower the insurance companies to do it, which is the way we've been doing it so far. It has some indirect means. Comparative effectiveness research is going to look at what new technologies work and what don't. There's some efforts to get Medicare to be more efficient, but it doesn't address it directly. But there is an anomaly in the law that Ian is pointing out. Those charges that the providers state are not the actual prices that are actually paid in most cases. Medicare, as David mentioned, has its own price schedule, and most insurers negotiate price schedules. So the $80,000 is paid by people who are self-pay, which is a small proportion of the population. Beyond that, they're really just fictions. But I would say if you can go to Spain and spend 2 years there and get your knee fixed and go skiing, do it.
We have a question. Our producer talked with Tom from Philly, and I'm not sure I completely understand this question, but maybe you will understand it better because you're the experts here. Tom from Philly says that he's going through the Medicaid process and that they don't cover pre-existing conditions. Does that mean anything to you?
That doesn't make sense.
Right, because that's specifically part of this law, that pre-existing conditions are not considered now when you sign up for health
insurance. The only thing I can think the caller might be referring to is if they have some retroactive debt or bills that go beyond a certain window of time. But I'm not. They should be covering pre-existing conditions. So for anything going forward, and in fact in Medicaid, it'll even look back a few months in many cases.
All right. I want to talk about the website, healthcare.gov. Rob Field, a lot of problems in the beginning. I mean, there were a lot of news stories out there. What's the experience like now?
I think the experience is pretty smooth right now. There are a couple of states that still aren't up to par. Massachusetts is one. Oregon is still having some problems. I've been on two of the sites recently. I got on healthcare.gov, which is the federal site that works for Pennsylvania, and I got on the New York site. My son lives there, so I wanted to help him evaluate his options. In both cases, I had no trouble getting in. I was able to see the plans, the coverage, the premiums. It went quite smoothly. I didn't actually sign up for policy, so I can't vouch for that piece of it. But they seemed to run very smoothly. It was as smooth as getting on Amazon or Travelocity or any of those.
So much better now. I heard someone say that whole process that the country really went through of all the problems experienced with the website may actually help the law in the long run, because we all learned a lot about how the law works that we didn't understand just by all the reporting that took place. Do you have any thoughts on that, Dave Grandy?
Well, you know, as much as I would have hoped that controversy, I think, would have helped, you know, bring about more knowledge of the law, I think knowledge is still quite low. I think the biggest barrier right now to getting uninsured individuals onto these marketplaces and getting them signed up is actually most people don't realize that there's financial help available to them. Mm-hmm. So the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation did a survey back in December of uninsured Americans, and I think it was only 40% of them were at all aware that there was even financial help available to them. So many uninsured people at that point had yet to even visit healthcare.gov because they just thought insurance was going to be too expensive for them. So what was the point? So I think we still have a lot of public education to do in this regard.
And we have people out there doing that public education. And this is a good transition to someone who's on the telephone. Laura is on the line, and you're a certified navigator. Is that correct?
That's correct. This is Laura Line with Resources for Human Development, and we are certified by healthcare.gov to be local in-person assisters. So in Pennsylvania, we sit with people who want assistance, or we answer questions over the phone and help people enroll, because as I agree with Rob and David, it can be very complicated, and in-person assisters do it every day. So,
What are some of the big questions you're getting from people?
You know, I think it depends on how your family is structured, and there are a lot of questions based on dependents and family structure, and then immigrant situation. So it can really vary dramatically. Every person's situation can be different.
And what are you doing to try to reach people? I mean, how do people know to find a navigator?
Well, we have an 800 number, 1-855-668-9536. That's 855-668-9536. And we have a site, rhd.org/navigator. But we do a lot of targeted events. We have an event on the 26th at the North Broad Street YMCA. We have events all over Southeast PA, Western PA, Berks County, Lancaster. We're spread across the state.
and we try to hold events with community partners so that they can help their members join us for the event, because as Robin and David said, a lot of people really aren't aware that this can help them a lot.
All right. Well, thank you, Laura. How is this navigator system working out, Rob?
I think for the people who seek out the help, it's great. But I think, as Laura pointed out, a lot of people have no idea it's there, the people who need it the most. I think this is part of the overall lack of communication strategy of the administration, kind of inexplicable from the very beginning, to explain to people why this law even exists. Most people have no idea, to explain how to navigate it. And then I think the problems with the rollout, with the exchanges, with the websites, did particular damage because it scared people away from having anything to do with it. So the communication, I would say, disaster continues, and they really need to do a better job of letting people know the navigators are there to help them.
I just want to point out that, you know, I think there's, if your experience, if you live in a state that is using the federal exchange, is very different than your experience if you live in a state that set up their own exchange. The federal government always thought, you know, when they wrote the law, that most states would do this. And so the states that set up their own exchanges actually got a lot more money to do outreach. And so we're in a state where we didn't set up our own exchange. So the resources to do this kind of outreach in Pennsylvania are very limited compared to other states that have set up their own exchange. So California is light years ahead, for example. They set up their own exchange. They have a lot more money to do outreach. It's like all hands on deck, and they've enrolled far more people as a percentage of the eligible folks out there than we have in Pennsylvania.
But then you have states where they haven't had a very good experience with a website,
yeah,
like Oregon, where
absolutely,
they're still having trouble signing people up. So you may be able to do some outreach, but if you can sign someone up for the website, that's another story altogether.
Right, and that's where a lot of the damage is done, is you tell people there's this great opportunity to get insurance, and then their computer crashes, and then you have to entice them back again. And the negative publicity has been overwhelming.
If you have a question or a comment about the Affordable Care Act, give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Also, you can send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. David Grandy, I want to talk to you about this Congressional Budget Office report. Actually, I want to talk to both of you about this, because this was a big deal a little while back. The Congressional Budget Office released a report earlier this month, estimated that some people will choose to work less because of the Affordable Care Act. And then that got a little twisted, especially by some of these vocal critics of Obamacare, into a message that the law is a job killer. Can you straighten this out for us? Let's start with you, David.
Sure. So there's an important – well, so let me talk about a phenomenon called job lock that people talk about in health policy. And that is people who are continuing to work so that they can get health care benefits. And if they didn't have to maintain a relationship with their current employer to maintain their benefits, they would leave that job. And they might be ready to, you know, be an early retiree. They might be ready to open their own business. They might be ready to do something else. But there's a way that people are tied to their employment because of health insurance in the system we have today. And through the new law, people have new options in terms of how they can get health insurance that don't rely just on getting it through their employer. So this is a statement from the Congressional Budget Office that was more about the decisions of individual workers to continue to work or exit the workforce or do something different, as opposed to a statement about what employers intend to do in terms of how many jobs there will be available. So that's where I think the confusion came about.
Is it confusion, or was that an actual effort to distort how people view things?
Well, I think it was politics as usual, and both sides tried to use it to their advantage. But I think it actually shows that the law is working, or at least is predicted to work. There are people who work second and third jobs just to get health care. They'd rather be home with their kids or doing something else. And then there are people approaching retirement who just want to hang on until they can get Medicare and would retire early, but they can't because of the health insurance situation. So what the CBO was saying is that these people don't need to work when they don't want to. They can get the health care otherwise. But, of course, it is spun by both sides to their advantage.
Sure. So that's, I guess, fewer people will be working, but that's their choice. And of course, then that job is open for other people. I know in my own family there are examples of people who are eligible for Medicare, but then their spouse is still 4 years away. And what are you going to do for that spouse if they don't have a job with health insurance? Now there's an option for that.
Yeah, or if they're lucky enough to have such a job, they're going to have to stick with it until they're 65. And a lot of people don't want to. They're beginning to get ill. They'd like to spend time with their retired spouse for all of those reasons. Other developed countries don't tie insurance to employment to the same extent, so they haven't had that problem.
All right. So I want to talk also about the number of people being signed up. Mm-hmm. Under the Affordable Care Act. I think there was a goal of that the administration had of signing up about 7 million people
right.
by the time the open enrollment period ends on March 31st. Is that going to happen?
Probably not. Joe Biden said the other day they're hoping for 5 or 6 million now, which I think is quite a concession. But remember, this is the first year, and this law presumably will be in effect for decades. So there's a lot of attention to what's happening now. Do we have enough young people? Are we balancing the risk pool? That's an issue, but it's not going to be fatal to the law unless it keeps going on 5 or 10 years from now. So if we do get 5 or 6 million, I think that's a fine start, and then they can try to build on that.
We have an email from John. He asks, the U.S. is the only country in the world that couples health care and employment. Is that accurate?
It's not entirely accurate.
Okay.
Other countries do couple it, but not the way that we do. In other countries, you're guaranteed coverage. Your employer pays for part of it. You pay for part of it. But the employer doesn't have to actually go out and get you a policy. The U.S. is the only country where you have to rely on your employer, if you're lucky enough to have one who provides insurance, to actually go out and get you the coverage.
Okay. So in this email from John, he goes on to ask, are we any closer to Medicare for all that would simplify the system? David Grandy, you're shaking your head no.
No. I think that, while there's, I think a subset of the population who wants to strongly advocate for that, I think politically in this country, you saw how hard it was to get the Affordable Care Act passed, which is a very centrist approach to healthcare reform. It's a very mixed public-private approach, relies strongly on the private market and private insurance. And even then, it was threading a needle to get it through Congress and get it passed. To move in the direction of a Medicare for All program means essentially, unwinding our private insurance system. And, I think the shortest pathway to a single-payer system in Medicare for All is if the Affordable Care Act fails, because there's not a lot of market-based, these kind of mixed approaches left to expand coverage in this country. And so I think if people want to preserve private health insurance, they need to figure out how to make this work. If they want Medicare for all, maybe they're rooting for failure.
I'm trying to imagine if you're an ambitious politician and you want to come out with a single-payer health plan right now, that politician probably doesn't exist at this point.
I don't think so, and they probably wouldn't be in office for very long if they did. Again, in my book, Mother of Invention, I talk about the history, and this has been an issue for 100 years now.
We're talking about Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. My guests are Rob Field, who you just heard there, and David Grandy. If you have a question or comment, join the discussion. The phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Also, email to radiotimes@why.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be back after the break.
Supporting WHYY Mendelssohn Club of Philadelphia continues its 140th anniversary season with The Sound of Spirit, Peart Heiden, featuring Peart's music from the recent Grammy-winning album Adam's Lament, as well as Haydn's Mass in Time of War, Sunday, February 23rd at 4 p.m. at the Church of the Holy Trinity, featuring the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia and soloists Barbara Barry, Jennifer Beatty, Roy Hagee, and Brandon Sadell. Tickets available at mcchorus.org, mcchorus.org.
So you told the sheriff that you were walking to Nebraska.
That's right. To get my $1 million.
On the next Fresh Air, Alexander Payne talks about making the film Nebraska, which has been nominated for 6 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actor for Bruce Dern. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The the inner baseball of songwriting.
In some ways, I think the songs are complete out there. And, you know, the better your catcher's mitt, the better songs you catch.
Roseanne Cash's new album caught a lot of great songs about her Southern roots, her musical life, and her very musical marriage. The Threads and Rivers of Roseanne Cash, next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act for another 20 minutes with Rob Field of Drexel University and David Grandy of Penn. And we've had a lot of calls from folks who listened to that navigator, the healthcare navigator who was on the telephone, and wondering how to get a hold of that organization. The organization is called Resources for Human Development. You can just go to Google, put it in there, Resources for Human Development, and you'll be able to find that organization and get in contact with them. There are other ways to find these navigators, correct?
They're out there. If you go to healthcare.gov, I believe it will send you to them, and if you just Google healthcare navigator, you'll see the list come up.
So we've been talking a lot about sort of on the receiving end of healthcare. Let's talk a little bit about the provider end of healthcare, because if you're a doctor or a hospital, this is a big change for you.
It's a big change, but it's a big change over time. So there were predictions that it's going to be night and day. January 1st was going to be Armageddon, and it was going to be the end of healthcare as we know it. This is a evolution. It's going to take years or maybe even decades. It builds on an evolution that's been going on for the last several decades. So I don't think most providers or patients have seen a dramatic change. I think we're going to see it gradually evolve. But I know, David, you've seen at Penn what's been happening.
Yeah, so again, I think everyone thought somehow the world was going to look fundamentally different on January 1 when you went to work as a doctor, and that's clearly not the case. You know, I think what we're looking at, even the Congressional Budget Office projects, it's about a 3 to 4 year window of time where these enrollment numbers will gradually go up and more patients will acquire coverage. So it's not like we're seeing some big influx of patients currently who are newly covered. So it's hard to even say that the world looks any different at all, frankly, right now. And in fact, most of the patients who are new, well, in fact, almost all the newly covered patients in Pennsylvania, because we haven't expanded our Medicaid program, have private insurance coverage that looks identical to the private insurance coverage that people have who aren't getting it through the healthcare law. And so, you know, I see patients, I don't know which ones are newly covered through healthcare.gov and which ones are not. And again, we're not seeing some massive influx right now, and I think it'll be a slow and steady increase over time.
Let's go back to the telephone, and we have Teresa on the phone. Teresa, you have a question for David Grandy and for Rob Field?
Yeah, thanks. I'm enjoying the show a lot. I'm a certified trainer with Pennsylvania Health Access Network, and I volunteer for them, and what we do is we go out and we give presentations about what is actually in the law. Anybody who follows this issue knows that there's been about, I think it's up to $400 million of political propaganda, I call it, just to persuade people to be against the law when we're not really talking about what is actually in the law. So I wanted to call and just point out that people can organize small groups in libraries or we go out. I'm in Bucks County, but all throughout Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania Health Access Network sends trainers to any groups anywhere just to talk about what is really in the law. There's so much confusion. Mm.
Thank you, Teresa. I've actually attended one that Pennsylvania Health Access Network put on a while back for a story I was working on for NPR, and I learned a lot during that hour-long session. We also have an email from Jerry. Jerry asks, I understand about the March open enrollment deadline. What happens if you lose your job and your coverage after that? Do you have to wait until the next period?
I think that would be a life change, and you can go on and get coverage in the meantime, but I'm actually not completely sure about that.
Right. That does sound like the what would qualify. I mean, there are certain experiences that you have. I think getting married is one of them.
Right. Getting a job, losing a job, and so forth. So those are generally exceptions to the open enrollment limits.
Okay, sounds like a really good question for a navigator.
Absolutely.
All right, let's go back to the telephone. We have Trish from Lehigh Valley. Trish, you're on with David Grandy and Rob Field. What's your question?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I wondered what incentive companies have for keeping insurance now that there's the Affordable Care Act. I heard that you said something about it, but I wondered, you know, why won't they drop insurance for their employees because the Affordable Care Act will now pick it up?
Well, part of the thing is that they're required to carry insurance, right, David Grandy?
Yeah, so there is a mandate for, as we mentioned earlier in the hour, for employers with over 50 employees. Some of the implementation of that mandate has been delayed. But I think it's interesting to look at what happened in Massachusetts here. So they had their law in Massachusetts when they passed it years ago looked almost identical to what the Affordable Care Act looks like. And they had an employer mandate with a very small penalty on employers who didn't offer coverage. And they actually saw an increase in Massachusetts of employer-sponsored coverage. So this idea that employers in mass were going to drop people from coverage and just send them over to these marketplaces and have them get it elsewhere, it didn't really materialize there. And I think it reflects the history of our country, which is that for, you know, 6-7 decades now, employment and health insurance have been tightly tied together. And many workers, when they go out looking for jobs, are looking for jobs with benefits. And so, you know, I think for employers to remain competitive, they want to offer those benefits. Certainly there will be examples, though, of employers who do drop coverage and decide just to pay the penalty.
There are a lot of health policy analysts who wonder whether that wouldn't be a good thing. We have burdened employers with providing coverage, as we talked about before. We're the only country where the employers actually have to get you the coverage. And maybe the system would be more efficient if everyone did go individually and get insurance through a website the way we now do for car insurance and homeowners insurance and so forth. Why is it such an important thing that we continue to link it to employment?
That sounds like sort of a half step closer to single payer system, except that it's more like single system, I guess.
Well, we would do it the way we seem to do everything in this country with healthcare, is that have the government involved, the government funds it, the government structures it, but it's all done through private companies. So even Medicare, in fact, is largely administered by private companies. So we would have single payer, but with multiple entities actually carrying it out, and we may be on our way to that.
We have a tweet from Joe who asks, what happens if you underestimate your income? So you go in to sign up and you underestimate your income. You're not qualified for the incentives or the help that that you get when you go to the website.
You have to reconcile it when you file your taxes the next year. And you may be able to get a subsidy retroactively, or you may end up having to pay back a subsidy if your income was larger than you thought.
So it's kind of like estimating for your
withholding
for your taxes.
Yeah, it's very similar. So I guess the lesson is if you think your income might change, be conservative in what you guess because you don't want to have to pay it back.
And there is a quirky thing in Pennsylvania, of course, because our Medicaid program hasn't been expanded. If you underestimate your income and you fall just below that level where you can qualify for subsidies on the marketplace, you may be told you have no options at all.
Yeah, that is appropriately called a gap. I mean, that's a gap in coverage that's taking place in this state right now. All right, let's go back to the telephone. We have Fred from Westmont, New Jersey. And Fred, welcome to Radio Times. You have a question for Rob Field and David Grandy?
Yes, I do. My wife took an early retirement. She had a package, and I was employed at the time, and we had coverage for a year under her plan. And then the thing we were planning to do is I was going to pick up the coverage at my employer because I'm 3 years younger than her. And by the end of that year, this big, you know, financial crisis took place. I lost my job. So we continued to pay COBRA, which is very expensive. So I went down to a navigator, I guess, in New Jersey, at Family Services, and found out to keep insurance, it'll cost more than we're paying in the COBRA now under the health care plan, which I find really hard to believe because I'm a big supporter of the health care plan. But I'm beginning to question how much support I should have for it because Mm-hmm. It's actually more than the cobra.
Yeah, this is an experience that a number of people are having, Roger.
So the first thing is your income low enough that you might qualify for a subsidy? Is it less than
four? No, and it's not that much above. I think it was $62,000. We're a little bit above it.
Yeah.
And that's not actually a lot of money, if you think about it. It's not a lot of money for two people working their whole life.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there are a number of markets where the insurances come in as quite expensive. It seems to have to do with how many companies are competing in each market. But when I went on the New York and Pennsylvania websites, I was actually surprised at how expensive the premiums were in a lot of cases, and also how high the annual deductibles were.
Hmm. We're going to go back to the telephone, and it looks like we have a physician on the line, Dr. Polner from Newark, Delaware. Do you have a question for our guests?
Yeah, I really think that this new plan for health care reform is going to probably fail because of these incredibly high deductibles and co-pays that people have to endure. What we're going to see in this country, in my experience, is that we're going to have a huge number of underinsured people. And underinsured means that they're not getting the kind of health care they need at all. They're staying away from doctors because they have a $5,000 or a $4,000 deductible, and they just can't afford health care. So I think this is one of the major problems with the President Obama plan.
David Grandy?
The high deductible that most people have.
Yeah, thank you for your call. David Grandy, let's have you respond
to
that.
Yeah, so this has been actually a trend for the last 10 years. It actually was kind of got a little boost by the passage of Medicare Part D, where there was a push toward these high deductible health plans. So this isn't new with the Affordable Care Act. Rather, you know, in some ways, the Affordable Care Act pulls the reins in on that a little bit, though there are very big deductibles in these plans. So what the Affordable Care Act does, though, is allows people to pick between these plans that are quote-unquote bronze plans up through platinum plans. And a bronze plan for the average person covers 60% of their medical expenses, and for the average person, a platinum plan covers 90% of their healthcare expenses. We're seeing a lot of people pick silver plans in the marketplaces, which are cover about 70% of people's expenses. The deductibles here in Philadelphia for a silver plan are several thousand dollars. So this is very different than I think what people are accustomed to, though lots of employers are doing this now on their own, and we're starting to do it even before the Affordable Care Act. And it's going to be a challenge for patients out there who experience these, you know, big kind of sticker shock when they go to the doctor and realize they have to pay the whole bill until they hit that deductible.
One exception you should be aware of is preventive care is fully covered without the deductible. So a lot of primary care visits will be covered, but it is an issue, and people will be underinsured.
Let's go back to the telephone, and we have George on the line. You have a question for David Grandy and Robert and Rob Field.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for the show. I assume there are a number of people in my situation. I'm not employed at the moment. I haven't been for a while, but I've been paying for private insurance since I've been unemployed. And so my income is zero. I'm wondering if there are any options for me in just getting my premiums reduced. I don't want to be on Medicaid. I don't think I qualify for Medicaid, but there's sort of a stigma attached to that as well. And I just want to a break on what I'm paying. And what you're saying, I think, is that there's this gap in Pennsylvania and there is no option for me.
Yeah, so, you know, with zero income, you would be looking at the Medicaid program, and if Pennsylvania were to expand it, that's where you would end up. The eligibility for Medicaid in the old system is really complicated. It depends, you know, are you a child? Are you a parent? How old are your kids? Are you pregnant? There's like all sorts of different circumstances. But for an adult, you know, without children in the home, you essentially don't qualify for Medicaid unless you're disabled. And so until Pennsylvania moves forward with this plan to expand the program, the caller is kind of out of luck in terms of thinking about what the options are.
Other than moving to New Jersey.
Well, we talked a little bit about this idea among healthcare providers that January 1st would roll around and the sky would fall dark and everything would be awful. Have there been any unanticipated consequences so far for providers and people on that end of the healthcare system, or is it just too early to know that yet?
You know, in terms of, you know, a lot of the focus has been on what the demand on the system is going to be. So are there going to be long wait times and are people going to struggle to find a doctor? Way too early, I think, to know the answer to that. Certainly, you know, having good access to a primary care doctor has been a problem in this country for a long time. We've struggled to train enough primary care doctors. So that system is going to be strained a little more. And I think the healthcare system is going to need to figure out how to adapt, bring in other kinds of providers, including nurse practitioners, physician assistants, to join healthcare teams to make sure that we can handle, you know, the influx of patients. But, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I think it's going to be a gradual process. So it's not like, you know, one day there's going to be patients lined up outside the door struggling to get in.
Yeah. And one thing, this expands mental health care coverage for a lot of people. Is there a sense that that's going to place a burden on the mental health care system in this country?
It probably will. There probably will be more demand. We'll probably see what we see in primary care is fewer physician or doctoral trained providers and more master's trained providers, nurses, and so forth filling in. But it does mean that more people will be getting care, and that's obviously a good thing.
Hmm. And so are there efforts underway to try and train more people to provide these services?
Yes. The law encourages training allied health professionals. It encourages better integration, hospitals and physicians forming what's called accountable care organizations where they can coordinate the flow of care so that people don't get caught in gaps and so forth. But it's going to probably take other legislation to really fill in the need. We're going to need to provide more residency slots for doctors. We're going to have to do something about the reimbursement system, which strongly discourages primary care. Yeah. So that's in stage two.
There's going to be plenty to talk about with the Affordable Care Act in the future. Rob Field is a professor of law at Drexel University's Earl Mack School of Law and professor of health management and policy at the School of Public Health at Drexel. He's author of the recently released book, Mother of Invention, How the Government Created Free Market Healthcare. David Grandy is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, where he specializes in health policy. Thanks, both of you, so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you'd like to learn more about this program, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You'll find links to our Twitter handle, our Facebook feed is there, and there's information on podcasts, where to find us on satellite radio, archives, email, contact information, and more. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moskowain.